From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, the political aftermath of the Gulf War, we talk with Joe Stork, the editor-in-chief of the Middle East Report. Also today, puns and paranoia. Writer Franz Lids remembers his four crazy uncles in his new memoir, Unstrung Heroes. And after decades of dealing with the arts, nature, history, and education, public TV's finally getting around to something really important. TV critic David Bianculli reviews this week's PBS special of Moose and Men, the Rocky and Bullwinkle story. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Secretary of State James Baker met today with Palestinian leaders from the Israeli-occupied territories. Baker called the meeting a window of opportunity, despite the Palestinians' assertion that they represent the Palestine Liberation Organization. The U.S. broke off talks with the PLO last year after the organization failed to condemn a terrorist attack on Israeli civilians. Baker referred to those contacts yesterday as terminated, but amended that today to say that they'd been suspended. A senior U.S. official, speaking on condition of anonymity, said that the Palestinians complained to Baker about Israeli curfews and the deportation of Palestinians. The United States and Albania will resume diplomatic relations after a break of more than half a century. NPR's Anne Garrels has more.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater calls the establishment of diplomatic relations with Albania, the last nation in Europe to remain under Stalinist-type communist rule, an opportunity to support democratic reform. Relations were broken in 1939 after fascist troops invaded Albania. The country subsequently became the poorest and the most closed society in Europe. Over the past year, the Albanian leadership has eased its controls. According to Fitzwater, there are some indications of democracy that we would like to help foster. Among them, the formation of opposition groups, multi-party elections set for next year, and a pledge to free all political prisoners. U.S. officials say the opposition in Albania had encouraged the United States to normalize relations. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
A Pentagon official says the United States is considering leaving some military equipment in the Persian Gulf following the withdrawal of U.S. forces from the region. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
Pete Williams, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs, says that leaving behind military equipment in the Persian Gulf would not necessarily mean that U.S. troops also would have to remain in the region. Williams says that Secretary of State James Baker, who currently is visiting the Middle East, will discuss what equipment might be left and under what terms. Williams also says that U.S. troops will have to remain in the region until a formal ceasefire is declared in the Persian Gulf War. The ongoing presence of U.S. forces is a sensitive issue among Arab nations. Leaving behind equipment also is controversial, as it could be interpreted as a way of circumventing Congress on the issue of arms sales. In Washington, this is Vicki O'Hara.
Iraqi opposition leaders claim today that troops loyal to Saddam Hussein have seized 5,000 women and children as hostages in an effort to force the surrender of Kurdish rebels. Kurdish leader Jalal Talabani told reporters in Beirut that the hostages were seized Sunday in the northeastern oil center of Kirkuk. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 17 points to close at 2,922.5. This is NPR. Kuwait's oil minister said today that it could take more than 2 years to put out all the oil well fires set by the Iraqi army. Rashid Salem Amiri said that the damage to Kuwait's oil fields was catastrophic. He told the Reuters news service that the heat of the burning oil fires is so intense that it's impossible to get into the fields to count them accurately. Amiri said that between 500 and 700 wells are believed to be burning. He said that Kuwait is considering drilling new wells while the firefighting goes on. The Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee today heard testimony for and against a plan to open up a coastal section of Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, ANWR, for oil exploration. NPR's Carol Ann Clark reports.
Energy Secretary James Watkins told the committee that Anwar has the potential to be the largest oil field ever discovered in the U.S. He argued that failure to proceed with the exploration there could jeopardize the future of the transatlantic pipeline, since production from Alaska's North Slope oil fields has been on a steady decline for several years.
We have a very basic decision before us. Are we ever going to permit the exploration and development of oil from new areas in this country again? If the answer is no, then we must be prepared to send hundreds of billions of dollars overseas to buy foreign oil.
Senator Bill Bradley was one of the dissenters on the committee. He argued that cheap oil and stepped-up production will only increase consumption and reliance on OPEC. Bradley supports higher prices as a means to reduce dependence on foreign imports. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
Delegates to the OPEC talks in Geneva say the oil cartel will try to cut its worldwide oil production by about a million barrels a day. The 13-member cartel is trying to bring production down to avoid an oil glut after the Persian Gulf War. World oil markets reacted skeptically to the planned production cut. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today, Secretary of State James Baker continued his post-war diplomacy in the Middle East. In these first few weeks after the war, we don't yet know how the Middle East will be politically changed. We invited Joe Stork to talk with us about the political aftermath of the war in the Gulf. Stork is the co-founder of the Middle East Research and Information Project in Washington, D.C., and editor-in-chief of the bi-monthly magazine Middle East Report.
The political aftermath of this war is something that's going to be measured over the next several years and not just over the next several weeks. I see this as a political trauma for the region that's very much on a scale, dimensions of the 1948-49 first Israel-Arab state war, the 1967 war between Israel and the Arab states. In both of those cases, for instance, it really wasn't until 2, 3, 4 years later that you really saw the political repercussions in terms of regime changes and so forth.
Some of the Arab countries have more power now than they did before.
Sure.
The Saudis, for instance, came out really on top in this war.
Yeah.
How do you think they're going to use their new power in the Middle East?
I think one thing you may see, the Saudis, who in the past behaved extremely cautiously, very much as the balancer, never getting very far out ahead of the Arab state political consensus. With this decision to bring in American troops and then all the subsequent decisions that followed from that, the Saudis have really sort of stepped out in front, so to speak. And there is a segment of the ruling family which has been very much promoting that, and I see that being somewhat understandable on generational lines. It's the younger generation, people like Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador to the U.S., who's the son of the defense minister, and others of his generation who've been very much pushing this what I call a pro-American and very sort of no holds barred, let's get out in front kind of line. Now, this is not something that it's not characteristic of Saudi political behavior in the past. I'm not sure how comfortable the Bandar's father and his uncles, such as the king, really are with this policy and with what the consequences may be. I think you know a number of things are going on in the region right now. There's all of the pressures that have developed, really intensified in Kuwait, for instance, for some sort of democratic regime, some kind of presence of a democratic opposition. The very same thing hopefully will develop out of the turmoil in Iraq. At the other end of the Arabian Peninsula, in Yemen, there you have North Yemen and South Yemen had a peaceful political reunification back in May 1990. The result has been an explosion, really, of democratic, popular political activity, a real liberalization, a real opening up, which is something the Saudis of either generation, but including the youngsters like Bandar, are not at all interested in seeing. So
why not?
Well, their position, their preserve, depends on the kind of autocratic, virtually dictatorial rule that they've enjoyed for the last 50, 60 years. I mean, they don't want to see that disturbed. The reason the Kuwaitis abolished their parliament in 1986, I mean, there were several reasons, it's true. For one thing, some of the parliamentarians started to ask questions about some financial scandals that the emir and his family were involved in. But one of the reasons came from outside of Kuwait, and it was pressure from the Saudis. They're not interested in democratic experiment on the Arabian Peninsula. And what they see happening, and I think it's something that would have happened with or without this war, but because of the war, it's sort of erupting rather than just sort of evolving. They're seeing this happen at both ends, at the southwestern end in the case of Yemen, and at the northeastern end in the case of Kuwait, for sure, and quite possibly Iraq. And of course, the Saudi game in Iraq is going to be very interesting to watch. I mean, you can bet that as we speak, they're shoveling lots of guns and money to their people, in an effort to make sure that what ends up in the post-Saddam shakedown is a regime that won't be too liberal or democratic.
Let me ask you about Syria. Now, Syria's position in the Middle East, I think, was strengthened as a result of the war. Its ties to the United States were strengthened as a result of the war. What direction do you think Hafez al-Assad wants to see politics head in the Middle East now? How do you think he would like to restructure things?
Well, I think, first let me make a general observation that I think actually what you've seen strengthened more than this state or that state is the state in general in the region, with the main exception being Kuwait. But I think, for instance, in terms of those Arab states or those states that allied themselves with the United States, in every case we're talking about a strengthening of the regime vis-a-vis society. This was not a popular move in Syria, not at all. In Egypt, at least, there was at least a passive support for the Mubarak decision to go along with the allies. In Syria, this was not the case. So I would say that's one case to watch and see just how strong Hafez al-Assad ends up being as a result of this. This was not a popular move. It helps, of course, that he came up smelling like roses, that the defeat of the Iraqis was so swift and apparently painless for Syrian troops. Assad was trying to position himself, actually. You can look back even before this crisis began and see this happening as a result of the decline of the Soviet role in the region. Syria had depended quite heavily on Soviet military aid, economic support, treaties of friendship and cooperation, and the rest of the package that usually goes along with relations with Moscow. All of that was on the decline. Syria was looking, the regime was already looking to reposition itself. It had renewed diplomatic relations with Egypt in the summer, actually a few months before the crisis started, back in the spring. There had been the first visits between the Syrian and Egyptian leaders since before the Camp David agreement. So this kind of repositioning had already been going on. And of course, this locks it in. And in a period of growing economic crisis affecting the region as a whole, the Syrians and the Egyptian state, at least, are relatively well poised to, if not gain, at least not be too badly hurt by what I see as a continuing process of intensification of economic crisis in the region, because they will be essentially renting themselves out as security forces in the Gulf and being paid handsome subventions by the Saudis, the Kuwaiti prince, and the other small ruling families of the Gulf.
A lot of people say that Hafez al-Assad is as tyrannical as Saddam Hussein. Do you think that he will become the next Saddam Hussein in the Middle East?
Well, or was he the past Saddam Hussein of the Middle East? You know, I think one of the unfortunate things about this crisis and the way it's been played here in the United States is this tendency to what I'd call Nintendo politics. You know, today's monster, we have to go in and defeat him. Then Mario, a.k.a. George Bush, takes care of Saddam Hussein. Who's tomorrow's monster? Or who's yesterday's monster? You know, it was Khomeini, or before that his name was Gaddafi. This sort of approach of it's really extremely short-sighted, and it's extremely I think it's extremely harmful to our own democratic values, but it's certainly extremely harmful to democratic possibilities in the region. So in a way, I don't like the question much. Hafez al-Assad's regime certainly is tyrannical enough. I think at the same time, it has to be said that no ruling clique ever in the region did manage to achieve the same degree of virtually totalitarian control over society that Saddam Hussein did in Iraq. Not because Hafez al-Assad is a better person, but it's just the various social forces at work in the country, the relative strength of the regime vis-a-vis those forces, he just wasn't able to achieve that same degree of control, and I don't think he will be either. So in that sense, Syria is going to remain. It's not going to be another Iraq.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Joe Stork, and he's the co-founder of the Middle East Research and Information Project and editor-in-chief of the Middle East Report, which is a bi-monthly magazine. Now, I know you opposed the war. Would you like to see any of the countries who were involved with the war going into Iraq to try to help the people who are being put down by Saddam's forces?
My general view of this is that these kinds of interventions are counterproductive. I do think that this instance, though, in this instance, you're talking about a situation where I would certainly like to see some way that the Saddam's guns could be quieted and could be silenced. I'm not sure, though, which outside force represents a realistic and politically healthy one to encourage to go in, quite frankly. So I think I would come down saying no. It's something that has to be played out amongst Iraqis, essentially. I feel there's a certain amount of appeal to the idea that the U.S., for instance, might move in to prevent the Iraqi forces from using poison gas. It's a good question. It's a difficult question to answer. I think in the end, that the political future of Iraq is something that is in the hands of the Iraqi people now, that the regime's capacity to put down the rebellions to the extent that they are happening, it seems, virtually all over the country, is a pretty limited one. And, of course, I'm all for preventing the regime, preventing the Iraqi army from securing the wherewithal to continue that fight. But given the interests of the various possible interveners, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, the U.S., etc., I'm not sure it's a very healthy thing to be encouraging or wanting to see any of them get involved any further.
Do you think that the uprisings in Iraq now are a positive outcome of the war?
I think they can be. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the break in Saddam's hold over the Iraqi people and the break in his military hegemony, the hegemony of his security forces, is a positive thing. I don't think it's an excuse for the war. I don't think it's why the war was fought by the U.S. and its allies. There are a number of positive developments, I think, coming out of this. I think, to go back to a point I made earlier, the tensions that have erupted in Kuwait and this what appears to be the obvious strengthening of those elements in Kuwaiti society who want a more democratic polity coming out of this. I think that's positive. That shouldn't be understood as some sort of endorsement of the war. But I do think it is one of the positive developments, and it's the kind of development that, in fact, we peace and justice forces in the United States should be encouraging. I don't think it's one that the United States government is going to be particularly encouraging.
James Baker is in Israel today. Are you encouraged about Arab-Israeli peace and Israeli-Palestinian reconciliation? And do you think James Baker's visit and George Bush's plan will help?
I don't know what George Bush's plan is, quite frankly. It has not been revealed to the likes of us, if there is one. I'd say let's wait and see. I'll believe it when I see it. This reminds me very much of the kind of wheel spinning and diplomatic charade that we've seen time and time again. Remember after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, we had the famous Reagan plan. Go back before that. At every point of crisis, the United States has stepped in, sending a Secretary of State or major political emissary over with this kind of talk.
Well, Joe Stork, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Joe Stork is the editor-in-chief of the bi-monthly Middle East Report. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews several recordings of blues-inspired jazz. This is Fresh Air. The form of music known as the blues was born in the rural South about a century ago, but it soon spread to cities like Chicago and Kansas City. Since its basic form is so simple and adaptable, its influence spread, too, into jazz, rock, bluegrass, and country music. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says the blues is one of our most precious natural resources, and it's infinitely renewable. He has a review of some new and recently reissued records that show the continuing effect the blues has had on jazz. From one of them, here's singer Big Joe Turner with pianist Willie the Lion Smith.
Well, I worked hard, baby, and I brought you on my bed. Yes, I worked hard, baby, and I brought you on my bed. Say you're certainly gonna miss me when I'm gone away.
The blues is the thread that stitches American music together. It echoes in the feel of songs by Gershwin and Hoagie Carmichael, in the sunny little ditties the Beach Boys sang, in the manic piano solos of Jerry Lee Lewis, and the slow cadences of the latest Colgate toothpaste jingle. Of course, it's at the heart of jazz, too, though some players build fancy superstructures on the blues's simple foundation. But there have always been jazz musicians who keep close to the basics, something underscored by three albums I've been listening to lately. The first is a reissue by blues shouter Joe Turner, who got his start as a singing bartender in Kansas City in the 1930s. In the 50s, he had a few rock and roll hits, like Shake, Rattle, and Roll. Turner's CD, I've Been to Kansas City, contains music from around 1940. It's a good collection, except that it's a measly 47 minutes long. His small bands include musicians playing jazz in a modern style, like saxophonist Don Byas and pianist Art Tatum. But Turner's vocals reach back beyond the blues to 19th century field hollers. Even when he sings about the city, he sounds like he's out in the sticks.
Yes, I dreamed last night. I was standing on 18th and Vine. Yes, I dreamed last night. Standing on 18th and Vine. I shook hands with Piney Brown, and I could hardly keep from crying.
Joe Turner died in 1985, but pianist Jay McShann, who came out of the same Kansas City scene, is still working and still putting out good records. McShann's new album, Paris All-Star Blues, was recorded in 1989. The band lives up to its billing. His sidemen include trumpeters Clark Terry and Terrence Blanchard, saxophonists Benny Carter, Phil Woods, James Moody, Jimmy Heath, and Hal Cornbread Singer, and the late drummer Mel Lewis. These players span several generations and come from widely different backgrounds, from modern bebop to 40s R&B, but they fit together amazingly well. That's a tribute to the blues' universal properties. About half the tunes were in McShann's repertoire 50 years ago. The only hitch is The band is a lot bigger than the one he had then, and the updated arrangements can get a little slick. But that's not a problem with McShann's piano or Ernie Andrews' vocals.
Stand before you with my heart in my hand. I want you to take it, mama, hoping that you understand. Well, baby, mama, please don't dog me around. You know I'd rather love you, baby, better than anyone else I know in town.
Jay McShann's All-Stars recreate his old triumphs, but another group, Jeannie and Jimmy Cheatham's Sweet Baby Blues Band, treats the classic Kansas City style as if it never went away. Forget that they live in Southern California. Jeannie Cheatham plays piano and sings, and Jimmy plays bass trombone.
Raunchy riddle of a woman, mistress of the black cat bone. Hey, she was raunchy. Mistress of the black cat bone. She brewed a powerful potion to keep dirty red at home. Well, when I'm warning all you women, you better leave dirty red alone. Warning all you women.
Like Jay McShann's orchestra, the Cheatham's Sweet Baby Blues Band features some great jazz soloists, like trumpeter Snooky Young and saxophonist Curtis Piegler. But this nine-piece group has a small band's rhythmic snap. On their latest album, Love in the Afternoon, they're joined on three tracks by guitarist Clarence Gatemouth Brown. He usually plays with electric blues bands, but loves to work with jazz musicians. It's no surprise that Gatemouth Brown blends so easily with Jeannie and Jimmy Cheatham. They may speak different dialects of the blues, but that doesn't mean they can't understand each other. Whether you play the blues plain or fancy, the basic vocabulary stays the same.
Kevin Whitehead is a frequent contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed albums by Big Joe Turner, Jay McShann, and Jeannie and Jimmy Cheatham. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Lots of people have an eccentric uncle. Writer Franz Liszt had four of them, four crazy uncles that shaped the author's life. Coming up, the unstrung heroes of Franz Liszt. TV critic David Bianculli's view of the world was shaped, at least in part, by a cartoon moose and squirrel. He has a review of public TV's tribute to Rocky and Bullwinkle. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Secretary of State James Baker today met a delegation of 10 prominent Palestinians. Despite a green light from the PLO, two Palestinians boycotted the meeting. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The Palestinians presented Secretary Baker with an 11-point document calling for an international peace conference, an end to the Israeli annexation of East Jerusalem, and Palestinian self-determination. Palestinians said they also asked Baker to resume a dialogue with the PLO, which the U.S. cut off last year. Baker said the dialogue had been suspended, not terminated. Hanan Ashrawi, a professor at Beer Zeit University who attended the meeting, said the group told Baker they fully support the PLO.
We stress the fact that the PLO continues to be our legitimate leadership and that we came here also designated by the PLO.
She said Baker agreed with Palestinians that Israeli deportations of Palestinians were illegal and that Jewish settlements in the occupied territories were an obstacle to peace. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Iraq's ambassador to Spain has sought political asylum and is now under police protection, along with his wife and four children. Spanish officials say that these defections occurred last week, and for security reasons, his whereabouts have not been disclosed. Students protesting Serbia's socialist government appear to have scored a victory tonight. Officials have met nearly all of their demands, and leaders of the demonstration, which swelled to tens of thousands today, called on the protesters to go home. Gabrielle Glazer reports from Belgrade.
The crowd blocking Belgrade's center roared with approval when news spread that their demands had been met. The government responded to the demonstrators by dismissing the top management of state-run television and releasing opposition leaders who were jailed after last Saturday's clash between police and anti-government demonstrators. It also appointed a commission to investigate the violence, which left two dead and more than 80 injured. Opposition leader Vuk Drašković, who was released from police custody, told the students that they were Serbia's future. He asked them to turn their protest demonstration into one of support for Serbs throughout Yugoslavia. Meanwhile, an emergency meeting of the federal government to discuss Serbia's political crisis continued. For National Public Radio, this is Gabrielle Glazer in Belgrade.
In Washington, the White House said today that the U.S. and Albania will resume diplomatic relations after a break of more than 50 years. According to White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater, the Bush administration still considers the country a closed society, but recent moves there have been encouraging. Diplomatic ties had been broken back in 1939 after Italian troops invaded Albania. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 17 points to close at 2,922.52 in very active trading. This is NPR News. OPEC oil ministers have agreed to cut more than 1 million barrels of oil production a day in an effort to firm up crude oil prices. The OPEC oil ministers said they had agreed to cut daily output to about 22 million barrels a day from the current 23.4 million barrels. According to one oil minister, Algeria and Iran indicated their reservations to the move. In Washington, the battle over this year's civil rights legislation was joined in earnest today on Capitol Hill. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Democrats say their Civil Rights Act would reverse several Supreme Court rulings that made it harder for victims of discrimination to sue employers, and that it would extend to women the same right to sue for monetary damages that minorities now enjoy. But Republicans say the Democrats' bill is a quotas bill that would lead to special and unfair preferences for minorities. The quotas charge is a powerful one. Democrats refute it. They've even included language in their bill that says the legislation should not be construed to promote quotas. But recent polls show that the public is opposed to quotas and believes that the proposed civil rights legislation would force employers to resort to them. Last year, President Bush vetoed a bill similar to the one the Democrats are proposing this year, and there were not enough votes in Congress to override his veto. The Republican leader in the Senate, Robert Dole, says he believes he has the votes to block a veto override again this year. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Also in Capitol Hill, more than 60 U.S. senators have introduced a bill to bring back the IRA tax break for all taxpayers, regardless of income. The bill would allow penalty-free withdrawals from IRAs and other savings plans to buy a first home, finance a college education, or pay large medical expenses. A White House spokesman says that the Bush administration is not in favor of the bill at this time. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest's real name is Stephen, but since his last name is Lids, he changed his first name to Franz when he was 16. He was under the influence of his Uncle Harry, who always called him Franz Lids, like the composer. But Harry was crazy, as were Franz's three other uncles, Leo, Arthur, and Danny. Leo, a brilliant, prolific, and unpublished writer, spent the last 34 years of his life in mental institutions. Harry, who believed he was the retired, undefeated boxing champion of the world, was released from his institution in the late 1960s. Arthur and Danny shared an apartment in the Bronx, cluttered with the results of Arthur's obsessive scavenging. Franz Lids has written about life with his four uncles and his eccentric father in the new memoir Unstrung Heroes. Lids first wrote about his uncles in Sports Illustrated, where he regularly writes about offbeat topics. To give you the flavor of the book, here's Franz Lids with an excerpt.
My uncles are smelly, screwy, astonishingly scrawny old guys who had abandoned everyday life. The world had packed them away in a back closet, like old sweaters. They still managed to pop up at the most inappropriate moments, subverting my mother's insistence on good manners and personal hygiene, and making a joke out of my father's cold scientific detachment. As a boy, I happily enlisted in their conspiracy against sanity. Now, as I write about these flickering men, I realize they kept me reasonably sane. Uncles, especially bachelor uncles, fill some odd cranny in families. They provide a hideout from the crushing commonplaces of our mothers and fathers. What do they know about kids? They give odd presents, never useful, mostly eccentric. They don't have to say no. It once seemed to me that every family I knew had at least three crazy uncles. Now if you have one, you have to cherish them. I had four. Uncle Leo, the literary genius, Uncle Danny, the paranoid, Uncle Harry, the self-proclaimed world champ, and Uncle Arthur, the connoisseur who had amassed the world's most exhaustive shoelace collection. They were at once close and inaccessible. I never thought of them as young, but they didn't seem as grown up as other adults. They lived outside the mainstream, old Reds who had survived the coffee house and delicatessen revolutions of the Lower East Side. My uncles were sons of immigrants, heirs of the shtetl, the ghetto, the pogroms, dwellers outside the pale. But they were happy to be outsiders. They never had to make the same compromises true adults did. They remained innocent and faithful to their own loopy dreams.
So what did these uncles do for you? What did it help you with to have these, like, wacky uncles around?
Well, I mean, my mother was dying of cancer, and my father became more and more detached, being a scientist, and inaccessible. And they provided me with sort of a safe haven. You know, they were very cartoonish. They seemed to be jarred out of the square frame, and they reminded me a little of Wile E. Coyote. If they had walked off the edge of a cliff, I don't think they would have fallen down unless they looked down, which, of course, was sort of not in their character.
I'm interested in their individual madnesses, like Uncle Danny was the paranoid uncle. How was his paranoia expressed?
Well, you know, he was the guy who he hated women except for his mother, and he wouldn't go to a horse race if a filly were running. So he basically stayed in his apartment with my Uncle Arthur, who was the collector, who had this huge cavern of junk. And Danny saw everyone as sort of an actor who was playing out this devious little playlet that was just there to make him vulnerable and kind of crush his will. And there's a scene where, on my eighth birthday, where we go to Yankee Stadium together, and he's, by the end of the game, he's just sort of cowering under the seats because he thinks Mickey Mantle is aiming foul balls at him. And then he sees Bob Turley is pitching for the Yankees, and Casey Stengel slouches out to the mound, and he thinks they're plotting a pogrom. So he was totally at the mercy of this this demonic director who was controlling his life.
And you enjoyed this when you were a kid?
Oh, it's terrific, just because no one else was acting this way, and they seemed to follow their own rules. And by their example, I thought that I could sort of escape into this this sort of funhouse world where everything was by different sets of criterion and rules. So
it got scary sometimes, too, though, didn't it?
Sure. In that apartment on the eighth birthday, I became lost in these passageways. It was just because it was just caverns and catacombs and newspapers and junk. And when it got dark, there was sort of no way to find your way. And I just got lost and thought I was going to die. I had asthma at the time, which is really the only thing I have in common with Proust. So I started inhaling all this newspaper dust, and I just was rocking back and forth and lost in this strange world.
Now, your Uncle Harry, I think it was, the champion uncle, who was institutionalized for a while.
Right.
So it really thought of himself as a boxing champion, and he once sent you this letter that you reprint in the book, and there's a sketch of him or a sketch of somebody in their boxing shorts in the ring,
right.
And then beneath it well, it doesn't reprint very well on the page, but he's written a lot of stuff very densely in small handwriting about, you know, his championship and all this. But you wrote him back a letter asking him, like, to tell you more about, like, the specifics of the bouts that he won. I mean, you were really taking it. Were you taking it at face value, or were you just trying to get into the hallucination?
Well, I just enjoyed it, and I wanted to see how much of it he really believed and how far into it he'd go. And, of course, he wrote me back this letter that said, "On March 28, 1932, I was challenged by Thratcher Muggs Charlemagne Fitzsimmons, alias Otto Otto, alias King Willie of Germany, alias Apocalypse Death. I stopped him in the second round with three solid rights. The referee made me watch the count." So I wrote him back a letter and said, "Well, why did he stop the fight?" And so his letter, as usual, came in one of these double-sealed envelopes marked special delivery, and it said, all it said was, "I broke his head." So I mean, that was an answer in itself that's perfectly acceptable to me. It sort of spurred me on to a career in sports writing.
Did it really?
Not really, but I wrote a story about him in 1983, and that's really what this book came out of.
My guest is Franz Lids. He's the author of a new memoir called Unstrung Heroes, My Improbable Life with Four Impossible Uncles. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Franz Lids is my guest. In your book, you write that what is endearing in an uncle can be deplorable in a father. How much of the hallucinations and paranoia and eccentricity did your father share that your uncles had?
I think he had elements of all the uncles, and he tried his best to deny them. And that's why he had this great love for reason, which in the end wasn't sufficient to ward off the insanity. But he always wanted to be part of society and unlike his brothers, and was never willing to really accept this legacy of four truly insane brothers, and that he was the fifth one. And I think it's the resolution is only reached at the end of the book, where He through chemotherapy for his own leukemia, flips out into this own world and truly becomes one of his brothers.
One of your father's real eccentricities was this obsession with punning. I mean, it was almost an affliction with him because he would pun all the time, and sometimes he would just hide behind puns. He wouldn't have to communicate with anybody because he would just make these elaborate puns. But there's a really funny passage in which your third grade teacher comes to the house for dinner, and your father starts punning like crazy. Would you read that part for us?
Sure. I would say that I think punning is antisocial behavior. I've come to believe that a joke sort of enhances or at least encourages a conversation, whereas a pun just stops it dead. And I'm sort of afflicted with that virus at times myself, and I have to really stop myself. But in any event, it begins. My mother is there at this feast. She's fixed for the third grade teacher, and she says to my father, "Remember, watch the puns," she warned my father when Miss Clark rang the doorbell. It was no use. My father's mind was a motor that didn't have an off switch. "What part of England are you from?" asked my mother as we sat down to eat. "I was raised in Nottingham," Miss Clark replied. "I was raised in Manhattan," said my father. "Fortunately, the rope broke." "Robin Hood lived in Nottingham," I said. "Very good," said Miss Clark. "Tell me," said my father, "when Robin Hood went to bed, did Friar tuck him in?" Miss Clark smiled politely. "Get me turtle soup, Selma," said my father, "and make it snappy." My mother smiled politely. Miss Clark said she'd be taking my class on frequent visits to the public library. "I want my students to get in the habit of looking things up." "That sounds terrific," said my mother. "When I was a boy," said my father, "I'd go to the library to look up dresses." My mother's brows fused in a deep furrow of displeasure. My father, however, had already launched a long arpeggio of corniness. "Ralph Will, Grant Wood. Frederick Schall, Bobby Shantz. Elaine May, Gallery Might. Kubla Khan." After a coy pause, he added, "But Immanuel Kant." Miss Clark seemed dazzled by this show of erudition. "You'd be a worthy candidate for Mensa, Mr. Lids," she said. "What's that?" asked my father. "A place for women who have problems with their periods?"
Was your mother always cautioning your father about not punning, trying to restrain him?
It was only when there was company over, and you couldn't shut him off. But she never really had that same assault. That she had reached this kind of inner place with him that he understood that he couldn't fend her off with puns and use wordplay as a shield. So she was the only one I'd ever met who was able to reach him that way.
Now, you talked about puns being a way of avoiding dealing with people. I'm reminded of a part in your memoir where you call up a girl who you have a crush on, and she says, "Do you know my father died?" And you say, "No, but if you hum a few bars, I'll fake it." And I was like, what a horrible, horrible joke. As if that joke wasn't old and tired enough as it
was,
right?
That's right.
To say that to someone whose father just died. I mean, did you have any idea what you were doing?
No, I was... puns had become so reflexive at that point that I just couldn't stop, and I felt myself becoming more and more like my father. And there seemed to be almost no way out. Jim, I was just moored in these dead responses that were disconnected to any emotion, and that was during my adolescence when I was at war with my stepmother anyway, so I just had this great sense of self-loathing, and that only sort of added to the whole malaise, I guess.
Your book is both funny and tragic. You know, funny because you tell a lot of stories in a very funny way, and you put things in a humorous light. But it's tragic in the sense, you know, your mother dies, a couple of your uncles are kind of certifiably mad. Mm-hmm. And you end up stuck with a stepmother who you don't get along with. So it's a tragic book in a lot of ways. But I'm just wondering if you ever worry about your own mental health. I mean, coming from a family where there seems to be an almost genetic problem with madness.
Well, I don't. I mean, it sort of confirms my belief that there is sort of it is in the genes. and not a behavioral thing, but it never really occurred to me because I think I have a lot of my mother's grounding. And I mean, I can, my sister I'd worry about more, but I think the abstraction is what I got most out of them, that sense of just being able to look at things a little obliquely. And as far as craziness, I think the line is blurred anyway between so-called normality and craziness anyway, and it's almost a societal definition. If you're put in an asylum or can't function, then you're considered crazy. But, you know, so-called normal people have many of the attributes, or at least a lot of the idiosyncrasies of crazy people. And I see in my own, well, I have two daughters, Gogo and Dee Dee. Actually, Dee Dee's name is Daisy Daisy, but the contraction is Dee Dee, so it'd have the two protagonists from Waiting for Godot. Anyway, Gogo I see as kind of a figure who has the capacity to spin out in space, and I have to reel her in. And a few months ago, we were in the Franklin Institute, which is the science museum in Philadelphia, and she was looking at all the exhibits on pendulums and propulsions and the laws of nature. So when we left the museum, she asked me if she could have a pretzel. So I said, sure. I bought her a pretzel. She takes the wax paper and drops it casually into the trash can and starts giggling. So I said, what's so funny? And she says, gravity. So I think it could be a good thing just to be able to look at the world from sort of a crazy angle.
Franz Liszt is the author of the memoir Unstrung Heroes, My Improbable Life with Four Impossible Uncles. Who can say what makes a little boy decide to grow up to be a critic? We think TV critic David Bianculli's life might have been shaped by his early exposure to this timeless piece of drama.
I didn't know you knew how to type, Bullwinkle.
Nothing to it.
Clee booty fergles up, pretty eagle.
Of course, that's just the first draft.
Coming up, David reviews of Moose and Men, Public TV's homage to Rocky and Bullwinkle. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. News today of Secretary of State Baker's talks with Palestinians in Jerusalem. Also from Capitol Hill, progress on the civil rights bill, similar to one that was vetoed last year. Also on President Bush's crime package and efforts to pass a gun control bill in the Congress. Also news from the Soviet Union, Ann Cooper's report on how Ukrainians are likely to vote in this coming weekend's referendum on the future of the Soviet Union. And we talk with historian and Richard Pipes about the Ukraine and Russia and what they have in common historically and the great differences that divide them.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. As part of their spring fundraising drives, many public TV stations around the country are presenting something a little less serious this week of Moose and Men, the Rocky and Bullwinkle story. It turns out, though, that Bullwinkle is a subject TV critic David Bianculli takes very seriously.
And now...
Hey, Rocky, watch me pull a rabbit out of my hat.
Again?
Nothing up my sleeve. Presto!
Wrong hat.
I take a 7.5.
A lot of people would be embarrassed to admit that one of their most formative and important early influences was a cartoon show. But one of the many things Rocky and Bullwinkle taught me was not to be too proud. It takes guts and a perverse sense of humor, but absolutely no pride, to make or enjoy the jokes that made Rocky and Bullwinkle famous. During the years that corresponded roughly with the rise of JFK, Rocky and Bullwinkle was to its generation what The Simpsons is now, an almost subversively clever cartoon show embraced by children and adults. Some of the puns in Bullwinkle were so deliciously awful that I've remembered and treasured them for more than 30 years. I especially loved the titles that ended each cliffhanger episode. One mountaintop adventure was titled, Avalanche is Better Than None, and a Panama Canal adventure was called, I'm Dreaming of a Wide Isthmus. Some jokes I got right away, like the intelligence-increasing hat called the Kerwood Derby. but others were like time-delayed joke bombs that didn't go off for years. It was more than 10 years after watching Bullwinkle that I learned that Boris Badenov, the Pottsylvania spy, was a takeoff on the opera Boris Godunov. And lots of the jokes, like the one about a jewel-encrusted toy boat with a strange name inscribed on it, were definitely not aimed at kids.
You know what you have here?
We were hoping that you'd tell us.
This little doll here is composed of ruby. Yes, sir, it's rubies.
No, it isn't. It's mine.
Well, my gosh, if it's made out of rubies, then...
If you're hesitating for me to finish the line, you've got a long wait.
And I don't have the guts to say it.
Okay, then here goes. If it's made out of rubies, then this must be the ruby yacht of Omar Khayyam.
And with that, little Jim, we ring down the curtain. What does fate have in the jewelry store? Be with us next time for Let's Drink to the Ruby or Stoned Again.
Of Mice and Men includes that classic moment and a lot of others. Scenes of Dudley Do-Right and Snidely Whiplash, Mr. Peabody, Fractured Fairy Tales, and, of course, the flat-out dumb scenes featuring the wonderfully stupid Bullwinkle J. Moose.
I'd like to start a box-top account with your bank.
Yes, sir. What kind? Just checking?
No, I really mean it.
The best thing about Of Mice and Men, besides its generous sampling of Bullwinkle clips, is its interviews with the show's surviving creative team. Animation director Bill Hertz tells about the Fractured Fairy Tale in which he made the prince look like Walt Disney, poking fun at the still-new Disneyland theme park.
Sleeping Beauty! I've come at last! With one kiss, I shall waken you and... Wait a minute. Awake, she's just another princess. Asleep, she's a gold mine. I can see it now. Sleeping Beauty comics, Sleeping Beauty hats, Sleeping Beauty bubble gum, and biggest of all, Sleeping Beauty Land!
Sure enough, the castle was soon made ready as a great tourist attraction.
My problem with Of Mice and Men, though, is that it tries too hard to be as irreverent and goofy as Bullwinkle, and doesn't really put the show in a proper context. For example, Matt Groening, who created The Simpsons, isn't interviewed, and he ought to be. When he started work on his TV series, he said he was using Bullwinkle as a role model. Of Mice and Men is fun, though, and it should revive enough memories to send you to your local video store, where the first 6 collections of Rocky and Bullwinkle adventures have recently been released. That's a lot of Bullwinkle, but it's all worth watching.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's producers are Amy Salah, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock are our production assistants. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Bela Davidovich was one of the Soviet Union's most prominent pianists. Her son, Dmitry Sitkovetsky, was one of the Soviet Union's most promising young violinists. On the next Fresh Air, Sitkovetsky tells us how he and his mother left the Soviet Union for the West. Also, the global politics of abortion. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.